Welcome to CRE Radio with Howard Klein. Our focus is commercial real estate, exploring vital questions, confronting commercial landlords, property and asset managers, investors, brokers, tenants, and anyone providing services to the industry. Your host is Howard Klein. His commercial real estate practice over 35 years has concentrated on broker, leasing, and property management issues. CRE Radio broadcasts are presented with the sole intent of educating listeners. Howard and his guests are specifically not offering legal advice. If you need legal advice, consult your own counsel. CRE Radio is available live and downloadable anytime at creradio.com. Call in during the live show with your comments or questions, 619-393-6492. Then press 1 to be placed in queue. And now, here's Howard Klein.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Commercial Real Estate Radio. I am your host, Howard Klein. Today's topic is buildings, blueprints, and lawsuits. Our featured guest is Jeff Reichard. Jeff is an attorney with the law firm of Nexon Pruitt. Did I do that correctly, Jeff?
That is correct.
Good job. Our call-in number, if you would like to listen to the show or ask a question or leave a comment, you can call into 619-393-6492. That's 619-393-6492. If you want to leave a comment, press 1 to talk. You could also reach us on Twitter using the @ CRE Radio, or leave questions at creradio.com. And somewhere in this broadcast, Justin, my producer today, an engineer today, will cut in and chastise me for not giving the specific URL for where you can actually participate in an online written dialogue about this show, leaving your comments.
Yep. Do that right now?
Yeah, sure.
How about creradio.com/blueprints? Huh. And that's it for me.
Okay, I'll remember that. Actually, Justin isn't our normal engineer. He's really our director of technology. But he's filling in today, and he's probably just thrilled that I gave him that opportunity. So let me tell you a little bit about this show. Because really, the way I got to know Jeff was that he had written an article, a blog post, whatever, however you want to call it, about architectural copyright infringement. I read the article, and frankly, I never really thought of it. I do have some background and experience with copyrights, but not architectural copyrights. And so I had a lot of questions in my head, and I thought that this would be an interesting topic to discuss, particularly now that we're starting to enter into a time where development is coming more into the forefront. So developers, contractors, architects, investors, everybody now is starting to think about doing more building and the design of those buildings. So I was wondering what the rights and obligations of liabilities that everyone has. So Jeff was kind enough, we did have a prior conversation, and he was kind enough to help me on that. Topic may be a little esoteric in that most of you listeners out there probably haven't paid much attention. But I think it's an important topic to pay attention now. That's why we're talking about it. So, Jeff, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Howard.
Well, and the quality sounds really good. Let me ask you the first question, and this is kind of in an introductory fashion. What are architectural copyrights, and what is it that is intended to be protected?
Well, to start off with, copyrights basically protect any artistic work. They can protect, for example, a book or a movie or anything that is artistic and creative and that's fixed in a tangible medium. For architectural copyrights, that originally was really just blueprints, things that were in a two-dimensional form on a drawing. But I believe it was in 1990, there was a piece of legislation that was passed through called the Architectural Works Copyright Protection Act, which basically protected architectural copyrights in any form, meaning a three-dimensional building or a model of a building is protectable the same as a blueprint is. So it's actually the architecture itself in whatever form is protected under copyright law.
Well, I'm not really sure what you mean, like the building itself. I mean, blueprints, you can see it on paper. So the drawings are protected. But when you're talking about a building, let's use as an example a modern building. I don't know if you're familiar with it. The Disney Center in Los Angeles. It's a very unique design. Mm-hmm. Do you know about it?
No, I'm not familiar with that particular building.
I knew I shouldn't have asked you that question. I should have come up with something a little bit, what would be new? Well, without going into the age and the distinction that protection might hold true, let's talk about, for the moment, the Empire State Building.
All okay. Right?
What is being protected about that? And again, let's ignore the age of the building and whether or not it is actually protected.
Well, protectability is something that it's hard to determine in every instance. There are certain portions that are protectable, meaning the creative portions that are essentially for aesthetic reasons are generally more protectable than functional portions of a design. Functionality is not actually protected by copyright law because that's within the realm of patent law. And so really what's most protected is the aesthetic form of the architecture. But with that being said, even if you had a general house plan for a three-bedroom home, the floor plan itself, even though it's not made for true aesthetic purposes, is also protectable because it is creative.
Well, how's this for another example? And we had discussed this previously. If you go to Las Vegas, there are quite a few hotels that have this almost the identical three-spoke design. I'm thinking of the Mirage. I'm thinking of Treasure Island. Of course, at the time those were built, it was the same owner. I'm trying to think of some of the other hotels. There must be four or five hotels that have this three-spoke design. Now, is that more functional? How could everybody copy almost the identical building?
Well, I think there's a couple reasons that just a generic three-spoke design wouldn't be eligible for copyright protection. The first one is that it's not a creative design. If it's just that general idea of let's do it in a three-spoke design, well, that's been known for years. Many people have done it. It doesn't meet the creativity threshold to be eligible for copyright protection. Also, it's more of an idea of doing it in a three-spoke design as opposed to an expression. And we can get into this later, but there's an idea versus expression dichotomy in which an idea is not protectable, but an expression of an idea that's fixed in a tangible medium is protectable. So those are a couple of reasons. And then also you hit on functionality. Well, if the form of it is driven by its function as opposed to its aesthetics, then it also may not be eligible for copyright protection.
Well, if the design is partly based upon the form and partly on aesthetics, how do you determine, do you totally lose your copyright protection if some element is based upon form?
No, you don't lose the entire copyright protection, but you may only be eligible for copyright protection in certain portions of your design as opposed to the entire design. For example, we have a couple of instances where we have represented individuals that are expanding facilities, and the existing portion of their building is not does not have copyright protection. Only the new portion is what you would be litigating. And so that's just a simple example of a portion of a building that is not protected versus a portion that is protected.
Okay. So before we take a break, I want to get into the issue of where copyright protection involves a bundle of rights and a bundle of liabilities. Before we get into what those rights and liabilities are, could you describe to us where these rights and liabilities come from?
Yeah, copyright law is it's statutory law to start off with. There are a bunch of different statutes under Chapter 17 of the U.S. Code, which deals with copyrights overall. But as we were previously talking about, copyrights originally were for protecting artistic expressions, whether that's in the form of a song or a movie or something that's generally more artistic than than an architectural work. And that's why it's hard to fit architectural copyrights within the copyright realm, and there are a lot of times when you have to make exceptions for copyrights, or for architectural works, I'm sorry. For example, you don't get as much protection for an architectural work as you often would in a purely artistic work because of that whole creativity issue and aesthetic issue that we were talking about earlier. And so there are a whole bunch of statutes that define copyright laws in general, and then on top of that, there's a lot of cases. It is federal law, so all the relevant cases that you would find would be in federal courts. And there's a whole bunch of famous cases out there and some not-so-famous cases that would determine who wins and who loses in each instance.
Oh, well, there's always a winner and a loser. So when we come back, we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, I'd like to talk a little bit about what rights that people obtain through the Architectural Copyright Act and other copyright laws and cases. So we'll be back in just a few minutes.
Go mobile with The Analyst. When the deal changes, and you know it will, be ready whenever, wherever, to update property analyses with The Analyst. Multi-page reports in seconds sent straight from your mobile device to your client's email. Environmental summaries delivered right to your iPhone or iPad in as little as 10 minutes. Free from your desk at last with The Analyst. Log on to creradio.com for Howard's comments, his one-on-one with developer Todd Kuhlman, and links to The Analyst.
This is Commercial Real Estate Radio with Howard Klein. If you have a question or a comment for Howard or his guests, please call 619-393-6492. That's area 619-393-6492. Then press 1 to be placed in queue.
Okay, this is Howard Klein, and I am here with Jeff Reichard of Nexon Pruitt, and we're talking about buildings, blueprints, and lawsuits, the Architectural Copyright Protection Act. Where we left off, Jeff, we were about to start talking about those bundle of rights that we're looking to protect. Let's talk a little bit about what rights people can obtain through copyright protection laws.
Okay. under copyright law, basically the creator of a work has the exclusive right to reproduce, to distribute, to publicly display. There's a whole bunch of different rights in there where the original creator, which in the architectural realm is often the architect or designer of the building, they obtain the exclusive rights within the United States to do those certain things. Well, and that's really what copyright law protects.
Well, let's talk a little bit about who really is the creator. Let's say a developer goes to an architect and says, look, I need a building. Please, do some blue lines for me and do some plans for me. Who owns that copyright?
Well, I mean, if nothing else is said and there's nothing else in writing, it's whoever was the original creator. In that instance, it's the architect that is the owner of that particular work. But if you take it a step further, let's say that the developer has already paid the architect for this work and for the ability to build the particular building that was designed. In that situation, the architect is still the owner of that copyright, but the developer has obtained a non-exclusive license to use that particular design and to build that particular design. So really, and by non-exclusive license, what we mean is that that architect technically could go and sell that same design to the developer's next door neighbor if they wanted to. And there's nothing that the developer could do at that point to prevent the architect from selling that design to someone else. And this is all assuming that there's no written agreement. If there is a written agreement, you can change who is the owner of that copyright and what types of licenses are given to whoever the contracting parties are.
Now, that's interesting, and I'd like to talk about this a little bit because my experience in copyrights has to do with advertising, general business matters, and I had once been general counsel, actually once, twice, been general counsel for some technology companies where we dealt with patents and copyrights and trademarks. And mm-hmm. one of the things that seemed, I suppose, common was that it struck me that most people did not understand that if you hired someone, if you hired an advertising company or designer or an artist to draw a logo for you, that just the mere fact that you paid for it doesn't mean that you own it and you can do anything with that other than to use it for that particular project.
Exactly.
That you can't use that design on other advertising projects.
Correct.
All right. And what I thought you had just indicated, that when it comes to architectural copyrights, if you are the developer and you paid the architect, you do have a non-exclusive right to use that design. Can you use that design on other projects without anything else if you paid for it?
It doesn't necessarily mean that you can use it for other projects. In that situation, the architect could come in and say, well, I sold this specifically to you for this particular project, and therefore you can't go and replicate it for another project. Where I think we may be going with this is into how you can transfer the ownership. And so, unless you have another question, we can go that route.
That's right where I was going.
That's where I figured you were going. Let's see. To transfer ownership of a copyrighted work, it has to be done in writing and signed by the owner. There's also a doctrine called a work made for hire, which essentially happens. It usually happens in the employer-employee situation where an employee that creates something may assign it to their employer via their employment contract. So work made for hire, usually in the architectural realm, doesn't happen unless you're talking about the employer-employee situation. There's another way that you can meet the work made for hire doctrine, but it's somewhat rare in the construction industry. And so really what you need to transfer ownership is a signed document that is signed by the owner of that particular copyrighted work that is saying, I'm assigning all of my rights in this work to you.
The actually, the typical language that I've seen in other type of copyrights is, well, usually the language that I've gotten from the creator has been, you know, that they own it. And then I have to go back and I have to say, nah, we're paying for it. We want to own it. You get into negotiations. And the language that we ultimately usually end up with, because the architects want to be hired, is that upon payment in full, the architectural copyrights are transferred to the buyer or to my client. Is that what you normally see in the architectural context?
Yeah, that's usually what we would see, and that's what I would advise most of my developer or general contractor clients to attempt to put into a contract, which is something that says that upon payment, you hereby assign all of your copyrights in this work and any intellectual property rights that you have in it to whoever is the purchaser in that situation.
And that's important in a number of different contexts. Obviously, it ensures that you get paid as an architect. And two, and I've been in a bankruptcy context where the fact that the ownership interest hadn't been assigned to the company that went into bankruptcy, it was very, very important with regard to the negotiating rights and when the bankruptcy estate was being bought out, what they were getting. And the buyer had to negotiate to spend more money to buy those rights that they deemed to be important. So those are certainly for the architect clients out there. It's kind of important to make sure that you don't assign anything too soon. Let me take a step back because I wanted to talk a little bit about who the actual creator is and perhaps a typical scenario. Developer hires the architect comes up with designs, and then spends a considerable amount of time with the developer, changing the plans, the developers contributing, discussing, saying, I want to change this, I want to change that, I want to do this, I'd like a different facade, yada, yada, yada. To what extent does the, to what extent can the developer actually be considered a creator at that point?
Well, in the true lawyer adage, it all depends. It depends on how much the developer contributes, and not just idea-wise, because remember there's that idea-expression dichotomy. It's really who puts the pen to paper is who's going to be the owner. Now, keep in mind we also have this creativity requirement as well. So if you're just as an architect, if I'm the developer and I'm looking over your shoulder saying, I want you to draw this particular feature right here exactly as I tell you, then really what you're doing isn't very creative for that feature. You're just doing what I say. But at the same time, me as the developer in that situation, I'm not putting pen to paper, so I don't have any right to claim that this is my copyrighted work. So there you're going to have an argument, and if it came down to it in litigation, it would essentially be a jury deciding who contributed what to this work. And the key being who put pen to paper. So it's difficult to draw a fine line there as to what is protectable, what isn't, and who has the rights in it, depending on how that relationship is put together.
When it comes to patent protection, inventors usually carry a daily book, a notebook with them, and they write their thoughts and, you know, whatever goes on. And that's partly how you prove that you've created something that it could be patentable. That, a lot of times that's what it comes down to. In the arguments, how often do the architects and the developers, do you think, actually really document what goes on in these meetings?
Well, I think that by documenting, as you said, in those meetings, it all depends on the architect. But once they start entering their designs in the AutoCAD system, then it's going to keep different revisions of each of that of the designs that they do for a particular project. So it should have the dates that specific designs were done and copies of the designs themselves within their AutoCAD system.
Well, great. We're going to take a little break right now, and after we take the break, we're going to be talking about really what infringement is and what happens if you do infringe an architectural copyright.
If you're a retail tenant, you really should belong to the NRTA. They're an organization of the tenants, by the tenants, and for the tenants. Whether you manage a large portfolio or just a mom and pop, the National Retail Tenants Association is on your side. NRTA exists to protect retail tenants everywhere and to make sure landlord billings are correct. Don't wait for your next statement of CAM charges to arrive. Log on to retailtenants.org. That's retailtenants.org. Find out more today. What's next for commercial real estate and retail marketing? Pop-up retail. And it's here now. PopUpInsider.com is the premier online resource for owners to advertise and fill properties for temporary use. PopUpInsider.com is where merchants and brands shop for temporary locations. See for yourself. Go to PopUpInsider.com. Create your own account. Market your empty spaces or view available locations for your business. All on one convenient site. PopUpInsider.com. Here's an exciting new tool for brokers and investors, RateBlend. RateBlend is a powerful online rent calculator that's quick and easy to use. Print and send detailed, effective rent analyses with a single click. RateBlend is easy to read, so what does your spreadsheet mean goes away. As a web app, RateBlend is accessible from your computer or any mobile device. Log on to creradio.com for Howard's comments, his one-on-one with developer Andrew Bermudez, and links to RateBlend. Try it today.
This is Commercial Real Estate Radio with Howard Klein. If you have a question or a comment for Howard or his guests, please call 619-393-6492. That's area 619-393-6492. Then press 1 to be placed in queue.
Welcome back to CRE Radio. I'm here with Jeff Reichert of Nexon Pruitt. We're talking about architectural copyright. So, Jeff, what is infringement in the context of architectural copyrights?
Well, infringement really means copying of a protectable design. But there are a couple of different ways that you can show copying. I mean, it's rare that someone has actual evidence that someone copied it, such as a defendant that's willing to admit freely in front of a court that, yeah, I took that design and I copied it. So one of the things that the courts do is they allow someone to be held liable for copyright infringement if the plaintiff can show, first of all, that the defendant had access to that protectable design, and then second of all, that the final product created by the defendant is substantially similar to the copyrighted design. So that's usually how someone is found liable for copyright infringement, is by having access to a design and then creating something that's substantially similar.
Well, let's talk about, actually, this was one of the first questions that I had for you when we spoke previously. As development starts now, I could see a developer going, hey, you know, I want to build this shopping center or this office building or whatever, and I really like that building over there. And I want mm-hmm. you to give me, I want you to put together a building for me that looks just like that. And he goes to the architect, and the architect puts something together. Now, the first question I have is it possible that the developer can have liability?
Yes, it's possible in that situation, because essentially what the developer is doing there is saying, hey, architect, I want you to go copy this building for me. And so what they're doing is inducing or contributing to the architect's infringement of that copyrighted design. Basically, a developer or an owner or really anyone can be held liable for contributory infringement if they, first of all, have knowledge of the infringing activity, and then they also materially contribute in some way to that activity. So in the instance that you just described, where the developer comes to the architect and says, design me something that looks almost identical to that, I think that would be sufficient to for a finding of contributory infringement, because they knew that it would be infringing. They knew of the other design, and they knew they contributed by saying, hey, architect, do this for me, and I'll pay you for it.
Well, yeah, there are a lot of facts or factors that can fall involved, but certainly it's possible. What is the infringing activity, though, specifically? Is it just coming up with a drawing? What actually has to occur to be considered an infringing activity?
Well, it's usually in the architectural realm, it's a reproduction of a copyrighted design. And as we were talking about previously with the two-dimensional versus three-dimensional issue, really it doesn't matter whether it's copying in the two-dimensional form, meaning copying on creating blueprints that copy another design, or actually building the three-dimensional building. That would also be infringement. So there's a lot of people in the contracting chain in construction that could be liable for copyright infringement when you think about it. Because let's say that there's a residential house that everybody really likes, and a developer comes to an architect and a contractor and says, I want you to build me this almost identical house. Well, in that situation, the architect would draw up the blueprints, and those blueprints would infringe. And at the same time, once the contractor starts building that house, the actual building would be an infringement as well.
Doesn't there have to be something unique about the building? I mean, we're not talking about a square building.
Right. I mean, it has to be something that's eligible for copyright protection, which really just needs a minimal amount of creativity. If it's something that's original and creative, then it can be eligible for copyright protection. But there's many instances where someone will... a designer of homes will post floor plans on their website or send out brochures to developers or individuals to advertise their particular homes. And if someone sees that brochure and says, hey, I kind of like this thing, this is a pretty looking house, and I love the floor plan, they can't just take that and go build it without providing any remuneration to the person who sent that that design out. They would have to compensate the original designer, or they're risking a copyright infringement lawsuit. And as we were talking about earlier, really, the owner could be sued for contributory infringement by giving those plans to the builder or the architect and saying, I want to build this house. The contractor who built the house can be sued for copyright infringement for actually building the three-dimensional building. And also, the new architect can be sued for architectural copyright infringement for creating the blueprints.
Let's take a different example. I am in the market to buy a building, and I happen to see this office building or the shopping center or whatever, and I really like the design. The numbers pan out, and it's a really great design, and it looks just like some other building that I've seen before that has copyright protection. So I'm buying a building that I knew is that at some point there may have been some sort of copyright infringement. If I buy the building, do I have some potential liability for copyright infringement?
Well, that's a tough call. I would probably say the answer would generally be no, but with a caveat. And the reason for that is because the exclusive rights that we were talking about include the right to reproduce. Well, if you're buying a building that has already been built, then you're not reproducing anything by buying it. And that's usually the exclusive right that is infringed in copyright infringement. But there's a couple of additional exclusive rights, such as the right to publicly display something. So you'd have to look into whether you owning a building that is available in the public for the public to view would be an infringement. I would venture to say that it would be difficult for the owner of the copyright to allege that you are publicly displaying a building, especially if they are seeking compensation from whoever reproduced it.
What about marketing material? If you're taking pictures so that it looks like this other building and you're going, you know, look at this building here. You can move in and it looks like XYZ building.
And there's an exception for taking photos of something where, for example, taking a photo of the Flatiron building in New York City. When you're taking a photo, what you're doing is, I mean, technically it's sort of a derivative work, but there is an exception out there that prevents that from being infringement. So there, you shouldn't be running any large risks associated with your marketing material, unless you're doing it in a form where, for example, taking a picture of the blueprints and then sending those out. Well, that's something different where you're really taking a photo of what the original designer did and then sending those out, where I would say that you could sue in a non-architectural copyright version of infringement, as opposed to doing it purely in architectural copyright.
So buyers really have less to be concerned about. It's the people who actually build it or are participating in the actual drawings, the design, and the building process.
Right. It's developers who are constructing the buildings, the general contractor who's building it, and the design professionals. I mean, it goes beyond the architect and can protect engineering drawings, for example, can be protected and have been protected in many cases, to where it's more on the construction side of things that you have to worry about architectural copyrights.
Outstanding. Jeff, we're going to take a brief recess now to hear from the people who pay our bills around here.
Techniques Marketing can help you do more business with your biggest clients. We've developed exciting ways to increase your revenue streams with your key accounts, way beyond mere trial and error. And we've done it for some of the biggest companies in America. If you're happy with your numbers, great. If not, we should talk. Techniques Marketing, TECH, that's the tech, NIQUES, there you've got your NEEKS, TechniquesMarketing.com.
Manage a shopping center? Always looking for new ideas? Tactics. Tactics Magazine is the idea magazine for shopping center marketing directors all over the world. Exciting promotions, gift with purchase programs, and full-blown ad campaigns. Every edition of Tactics is packed with features, ideas, and news you can use to get the word out and grow your numbers. How can you manage a shopping center without your tactics? Log on to TacticsMagazine.com. Today would be good. TacticsMagazine.com.
If you need anything with your company logo on it, you need Monogram Magic. T-shirts, ball caps, polo shirts, anything. Monogram Magic does it beautifully, does it right, and does it right on time. For over 20 years, Monogram Magic has produced corporate apparel your people will be proud to wear. Large orders or small, it's all about attention to detail. See for yourself. Here's the website, logostolife.com. That's LOGOS, the number 2, then LIFE.com, logostolife.com.
This is Commercial Real Estate Radio with Howard Klein. If you have a question or a comment for Howard or his guest, please call 619-393-6492. That's area 619-393-6492. 6492, then press 1 to be placed in queue.
Welcome back to CRE Radio. I'm your host, Howard Klein. I'm with Jeff Reichard. So, Jeff, let's now talk about what happens if you infringe on an architectural copyright. What are the liabilities? And I'm sure that you're going to get into this, but it also makes a difference whether or not you've registered your copyright. So why don't you get into that whole conversation now?
Okay. Well, let's first take the example of someone who has not registered their copyright. In that instance, the damages associated with copyright infringement are still pretty steep. I mean, you have the actual damages that were caused to the owner of that copyrighted design, and also the plaintiff would be entitled to any profits of the infringer that are attributable to that infringement. So not only would the plaintiff get their actual damages like they would in a breach of contract action, they would also have a disgorgement of profits that the infringer obtained due to the copyright infringement, which can be a lot of money. And that's when there has not been a copyright registration. And
what do you mean by a copyright registration?
Well, a copyright registration, it's pretty simple to register a copyright. Basically, you send a copy of whatever the design is to the U.S. Copyright Office, and you send them a certain amount of money. It's usually about $50 for registration, and the Copyright Office will send you back an official registration for whatever that design is. And so the key thing about the registration is the date that you obtain that registration. If the creator obtains a registration for that copyrighted work before the infringer, quote, commences their infringement, then you're entitled to some enhanced damages. For example, you're entitled to choose between the actual damages and profits that we just talked about or statutory damages. And statutory damages really means that the plaintiff wouldn't have to show how much they were actually damaged based on that particular infringement. The court would essentially assign a monetary amount based on whether or not the court believed that the infringement was innocent or willful infringement. And that can range all the way up to $150,000 per infringement. And so, and in addition to those statutory damages, if you have timely registered your copyrights, you would also be entitled to attorney's fees, which in copyright litigation can be very expensive, especially because it is it's done in federal court, which often is much more expensive than state court.
Oh, those attorneys just get you all the time.
They do. They do.
So let me ask you, when you mentioned per infringement, mm-hmm. what do you mean by per infringement? Could taking a building design, is that what, one infringement? Or could there be multiple infringements in copying a particular building?
And that depends. I mean, it's something that's arguable. For example, you could try and argue, well, when you designed it and put it in the two-dimensional form, that was one infringement. And then when you built it, that's another infringement, because both of those were reproductions, but they were separate reproductions. And that's an argument that can be made. It's unclear where the line is drawn, because it's essentially a question of fact that would be put forth to a jury or a judge. And so it's often not the subject of case law, and it's something that can be argued either way. So it's not clear.
What about different elements of creativity? You know, this part of the building is very creative, and it's different from that part of the building, which is also very creative. Is it possible that that could be considered, for instance, in that particular instance, two infringements?
I would say no, because really what you're talking about is one work there. You're talking about one building where even though it's different aspects of the building that are protectable, my reproduction of the building as a whole would be one reproduction, even if it's different aspects that are protectable of that same work. The key is that it's one work.
Unless they were developed and built and designed at different times.
Correct. If you're talking about different buildings, then yeah, those would be different infringements.
Let me again interrupt you. I know I'm destroying your line of thought here. You had mentioned something about registration. Mm-hmm. As to registration, is the mere fact of registration, is that conclusive that the person who created something, that they have a protectable copyright?
No, it's not conclusive. Really, when you look at what the Copyright Office does, is they just take a sample of whatever it is that you send them and send you back a registration certificate. They're not examining it to determine, is this something that is protectable under copyright law? So, although the burden does shift to the whoever the infringer would be in that situation to establish that this is not protectable. But no, it's not indisputable by any means.
So, you know, when you're comparing, if you've registered, one of the other things, I don't recall exactly if you had mentioned this, but if you register, you have the choice of statutory damages. You don't have to prove actual damages. You can also get actual damages. And if you register, can you also get infringer's profits or disgorgement of profits?
The profits you can get regardless of whether you register or not. When we talk about actual damages, in copyright law, actual damages actually means the, quote, actual damages plus the profits of the infringer that are attributable to the infringement. So that's separate and apart from the statutory damages. And the enhanced damages that you get from registration are the ability to get statutory damages and the ability to get attorney's fees. So that's really the big bonus. And those can be big bucks to where for architects out there, I mean, if there is any idea that there could be a dispute regarding a particular particular design that you have, there's no reason not to go ahead and register that. I mean, it's cheap and easy to do, and for the architects out there, I would suggest register early and register often.
When you had mentioned attorney's fees, let's say you go ahead and you register your copyright. Then you have the ability to get attorney's fees. You can file a suit against an infringer. The argument then is going to be from the accused infringer. Their argument is going to be, look, this wasn't unique. It wasn't creative. It wasn't a protectable copyright for various reasons. Now, the burden is then on the accused infringer. Maybe I shouldn't be using the word accused because it kind of sounds like some sort of criminal liability, and we know that it's not. If the alleged infringer is successful, can they get attorney's fees?
If the alleged infringer is successful?
Yeah, if they're
able... they're able to defend the copyright action?
That's correct.
It's rare, but it's a possibility. But it often does not happen. I would say usually does not happen.
Why not?
Because really, in the U.S. system, the status quo is that each party pays their own attorney's fees. It's only in exceptional circumstances that a court would award attorney's fees to one side or the other.
Well, let me just stop. Let me stop you there a second. What you're telling me is if you go ahead and you register your copyright, then only because of that statutory right that you have now availed yourself, you will be entitled to attorney's fees for prosecuting successfully prosecuting a copyright infringement lawsuit. Isn't that right then given to someone who is defending it, who may be going, hey, you know, you're just harassing me?
Well, the right is not given to the infringer by that particular statute. And in that particular statute, it doesn't say that the plaintiff, meaning the original designer and owner of the copyright, is entitled to attorney's fees no matter what. The court can still decide at that point whether or not they feel that the attorney's fees are justified. So the court can determine in its discretion whether it is going to award those attorney's fees. But with this particular statute, usually if there is timely registration and the plaintiff wins, then they usually award attorney's fees in addition to the damages. On the other hand, though, in my experience, is that regardless of whether there's registration or not, a successful defense of a copyright infringement suit doesn't necessarily mean that the judge is going to award attorney's fees unless there's some exceptional circumstances, like it's completely unmerited, the suit was frivolous or something of that extent.
That seems a little unfair to me. But then again, the law is not a question of fair or not, and it's not an issue of justice, as we have all learned in law school. Okay, so Now, oh, where are my notes? Oh, well, here's one of, why don't we take a brief break? And when we come back, I'd like to talk a little bit about how do people, you'd have to assume that if someone likes a design and they want to copy it, kind of, you know, is there a really way around it by making a few changes? So why don't you cogitate on that issue while we're taking a brief break, and then we'll come back and talk about that, okay?
If you need anything with your company logo on it, you need Monogram Magic. T-shirts, ball caps, polo shirts, anything. Monogram Magic does it beautifully, does it right, and does it right on time. For over 20 years, Monogram Magic has produced corporate apparel your people will be proud to wear. Large orders or small, it's all about attention to detail. See for yourself. Here's the website, logostolife.com. That's L-O-G-O-S, the number 2, then L-I-F-E.com. Logostolife.com. If you're a retail tenant, you really should belong to the NRTA. They're an organization of the tenants, by the tenants, and for the tenants. Whether you manage a large portfolio or just a mom and pop, the National Retail Tenants Association is on your side. NRTA exists to protect retail tenants everywhere and to make sure landlord billings are correct. Don't wait for your next statement of CAM charges to arrive. Log on to retailtenants.org. That's retailtenants.org. Find out more today.
What's next for commercial real estate and retail marketing? Pop-up retail. And it's here now. PopUpInsider.com is the premier online resource for owners to advertise and fill properties for temporary use. PopUpInsider.com is where merchants and brands shop for temporary locations. See for yourself. Go to PopUpInsider.com. Create your own account. Market your empty spaces or view available locations for your business. All on one convenient site, PopUpInsider.com.
Okay, we're back now. And Jeff, you with us?
I'm here.
Great. All right, so here I am, a developer, a builder, or an architect, and I see, you know, a design that I really, really like, but I don't want to be liable for copyright infringement. So how do I kind of get the general sense of another build? Well, I'm not going to ask you how to basically copy something without having liability, but what is it that people tend to do to try to avoid that liability?
Well, there's a couple of things that you can do. The first thing that I wanted to discuss related to that issue, though, is if you just basically make minor changes to an existing design, you may still be infringing. That's something you got to watch out for. Because remember, we were talking about that substantial similarity test. It's not that it's identical to the other design. It's that it's substantially similar. And really, there's a couple of different tests that courts use throughout the U.S., and it depends on where you are geographically in the United States. But there's a couple of different tests, like the total look and feel test, where essentially a juror would have to put themselves in the shoes of just an ordinary observer looking at the entirety of the design, and do they feel that it looks substantially similar by looking at the entire design. But there's also another test called the filtration test, in which the court tries to filter out all of the unoriginal or unprotectable portions of the work, and then have the jury look at the design, the remaining protectable portions of the design, and then determine if that protectable portion is substantially similar. So when it comes to changing a design to try and get around infringement, it's a tough call as to what is sufficient to make it not substantially similar. And that's always a difficult issue. So beyond that, beyond just making tweaks to the actual design, there's a couple of things that you can do. One of those is you can try and include indemnification language in a contract that you have with, for example, a designer. Although it may not work if you are the one that is causing the infringement. For example, if you have a developer that contracts with an architect, you as a developer can require a contractual provision that says that the architect is going to indemnify the developer for any and all intellectual property infringements, including copyright infringement, including attorney's fees to defend the copyright action, all of that stuff in there. And that should be sufficient to make the architect come in and have to defend the developer in that situation. However, if the developer was the one who handed the architect the blueprint and said, I want you to go design this for me, then chances are that indemnification agreement is going to be tossed out in court. So it's once again a fine line that you walk there to try and obtain some indemnification for copyright infringement. Although I recommend for owners and developers in all of your contracts with an architect that you try and include this indemnification language, because what if, without your knowledge, the architect goes and rips off somebody else's design? Well, as the owner, you might get sued. And so that's a good place to have that indemnification agreement.
Well, it sounds like to me that if you're either an architect or developer or contractor, you really need someone like a Jeff Reichard to kind of help you along with this, huh?
Yeah, I mean, we help everybody in the contracting chain. We've sure. represented many developers and owners, contractors, designers. We've represented everybody in the contracting chain, and we've run into many of these messes before. And an indemnification clause is a great thing to have.
Well, yeah, I want to. Did you have something else to say on that issue? I'm sorry.
Oh, I was just gonna talk about insurance as well.
Yes.
There are situations in which insurance can cover copyright infringement. However, in most insurance contracts for general liability insurance, it covers copyright and trademark infringement related to advertising injuries. And there's, I think they call it an advertising injury clause, where it covers any copyright infringement related to your advertising. But here, we're not talking about advertising. We're talking about construction. So a lot of times an insurance company will try to get out of coverage for an architectural copyright infringement claim. And in this situation, you can buy insurance coverage for architectural copyright infringement, but that's something where I would suggest contacting your insurance professional, your insurance agent, to ensure that you have coverage for architectural copyright infringement, just to be sure, because even though sometimes you take a quick read of your insurance agreement and you see copyright in there, it may be excluded under that advertising injury exclusion that we were talking about.
That's a great point. We're beginning to run out of time, and there were a couple of things that I want to make sure that we get in that I know that we haven't yet addressed. Then there are a whole bunch of things that you and I discussed that we're not even going to be able to get in. But if I wanted to design a building, or I wanted to build a building that looked just like the Flatiron Building, or for that matter, the Eiffel Tower, am I going to infringe a copyright by doing that?
Well, that depends, because you chose some pretty old buildings there. The life of a copyright at the moment, and it's changed in the past many times, but it the life of a copyright is for the life of the creator plus an additional 70 years, meaning that whoever created, for example, the Eiffel Tower, they have the exclusive rights in that copyrighted design until 70 years after that person's death. Once that 70 years after the death has occurred, it's free game and anybody can use that design. But before that time period, no, you can't just go and copy somebody else's design, because then you're running a serious risk of being hit with a copyright infringement lawsuit.
So the Eiffel Tower shouldn't be a problem, but I'm not sure when the creator of the Flatiron Building died.
Right. And it, that's the key right there.
Yeah, I'm assuming it is more than his lifetime in 30 years, but I'm not entirely sure of that. Also, we talked about rights being territorial. What did you mean by that?
Territoriality means that what we've been discussing here today is all law within the United States. So if the infringement occurs within the United States, the laws we've been discussing today apply. But if the infringement occurs somewhere outside of the boundaries of the United States, then wherever that infringement occurs, it's the laws of that particular country that are going to determine whether or not it is copyright infringement and what are the damages associated with it.
So if the building is built in France, you're going to have to rely upon French or EU law, right?
Correct. It's really, the key is, where does the infringement occur?
So
because
okay,
you have to have jurisdiction over that particular infringer.
Well, the question I am going to then ask is, is the actual rights territorial, meaning if the building is in Shanghai and you go ahead and you create the building here in the United States, is that design protectable here in the United States?
Yes, yes. If the original building was created in Shanghai and then someone here in the United States tried to build it, the owner of the and the original creator that, let's say, lives in Shanghai has those rights within the United States as well as the creator. Granted, I'd imagine in that example that they are not registered copyrights, but still, as the creator, is entitled to copyrights within the United States.
So you're talking about every building in the world you could potentially infringe. Is intent to infringe relevant?
Yes and no, depending on the type of infringement. But I think the best thing for our listeners to think about is, no, it's innocent infringement is not a defense to copyright infringement. That you would still be entitled, the plaintiff in a copyright infringement action would still be entitled to those actual damages and profits of the infringer, regardless of whether it was an intentional infringement or not. The only time that intent would come into play is if we start talking about those statutory damages, where it's a spectrum from $0 to $150,000 per infringement, based on whether or not it was willful infringement or innocent infringement. But that's only for statutory damages. So if the plaintiff elected to do regular actual damages and profits, the intent of the infringer does not matter.
Okay. What about injunctive relief?
Yeah, that's something that that you would be entitled to under copyright law. For example,
why don't you explain to the listeners what injunctive relief is?
Well, injunctive relief, one of the biggest things about injunctive relief is stopping the construction. that if the construction of an infringing building is considered an infringement, then the plaintiff could go to the court and say, I want you to grant me an injunction forcing them to stop building this building. And so an injunction is something that basically it's a court order that can prevent somebody from doing something. In that situation, prevent them from building the building, which in the construction industry, time is money. And so halting the construction of a building would be very costly to everybody.
And injunctive relief is still available even if it's the architectural work is not copyrighted.
I'm not sure I understand what you mean by if it's not copyrighted.
Well, do you registered? That shows my ignorance.
In that situation, it would be much harder to get, but yes, it would still be available.
Okay, one last thing that I'd like to talk about before we get to the closing of the show. You had mentioned something that I wasn't familiar with, but this is something that is particular to builders, developers, architects, and lawyers who are involved with them. What are design-build projects, and what is the significance vis-a-vis architectural copyright law?
Well, a design-build project is a project delivery system that's been used a lot in the construction industry in the past maybe 10 or 20 years. Really, it's a change from the old model, which was design, bid, build, where in the old system, the design, bid, build system, you think about it as different phases, where you pay somebody to design the building, the architect. Then the next phase is that you have all your contractors come in and bid that work. And the final phase is you build that work. Well, and that's the old design, bid, build project delivery system. One of the newer systems that people are using now is design, build, which means that the same entity designs it and builds it. So often in those situations, you have a contractor slash architect that collectively submits a bid and a design at the same time to the owner and says, here is what I plan to build for you. This is my design, and this is what I think it's going to cost to build it. So you would have, for competitive bidding in the design build process, you may have five different designs, each one with a separate bid of how much it's going to cost to build it. And we've run into a lot of problems lately with design build projects in which an owner may attempt to take a design from one bid and try and match it up with a contractor from another bid and say, well, yeah, I like your numbers for this one, contractor, but I want you to build this design that was submitted by some other group. And in that situation, you can run into a lot of problems because really what you're doing is saying, ooh, I like this design, but I want somebody else to build it.
Well, you'd like your cake and eat it too. And that's
exactly.
Yeah, that's what we were talking about. Well, we're now in the position where we're going to have to roll up the show and conclude it. Before I do, I'd like to ask you, how do people get in touch with you and what's your website?
Well, people can get in touch with me on the internet via email. They can call. The website to my firm is nexenpruitt.com, which is NexenPruitt. And my name is Jeff Reichard. My last name is spelled Reichard. You can Google me, and you can send me an email if you'd like to as well, which my email address is jreichard@nexenpruitt.com. And my telephone number is area code 336-387-5139. And I actually specialize, I split my time between construction and intellectual property. I'm a patent attorney as well, and so architectural copyrights is one of the rare times where there's actually overlap between intellectual property and construction. So it's something I enjoy doing a lot.
You're a mutt. You're a legal mutt. All right. What else? Do you have anything else coming up of any significance that you would like the listeners to know about?
I actually have a you talked about it earlier in the show, but I had drafted up just a quick and simple article called The 10 Things You Must Know About Architectural Copyrights. And that's available on the website for our firm. If you go to my particular bio on our firm website, and it really goes over the 10 things that you most need to know. And we discussed a lot of those today, but for our listeners that want something that they can read, it's just a quick hit, couple of pages of what you need to know most.
And I'm going to write up an article and address some of those issues. But I do recommend that whoever is listening to this go to Jeff's website, because it really is a good article. Caught my attention, certainly. Now, let me just tell you what I've got coming up. Actually, we're going to be on a brief sabbatical vacation. So our next show is really not going to occur until April 19th. At that time, we're going to be doing a green building and sustainability show with David Pogue, who's head of sustainability for CBRE. We'll, I believe you pronounce his last name, Teichman or Teichman. And I just got off the phone with Will a few hours ago. He's head of sustainability for Kimco. And Constantine Contacosta. Oh, I'm terrible at last names. And Constantine is actually, I'm not sure of his exact title, but he's kind of head of sustainability at NYU, and he's very, very involved with a lot of what New York City is doing on sustainability and green buildings, and it's going to be a fascinating show. I got some great guests on that. We've got a show coming up in early May called The Art of Balance with currently two guests, Barbie Ryder and Miriam Bouget, where we're going to be talking about the balance between family life and children for women, and trying to be very successful people in commercial real estate. A little bit of that discussion regarding the Leaning In book. So we'll be talking about that. And then since we're on the subject, we have a show that we're about to schedule on marijuana collectives and the controversial tenant. And actually, we expect to have some legislators from Congress on that show. There'll be a couple of other attorneys and other representatives talking about the various laws, what the Attorney General's office has been doing in terms of going after landlords for renting to tenants who sell marijuana collectives or who are marijuana collectives, even in states where state law makes it legal, which is a very interesting situation. And I have been in litigation representing a landlord in a similar instance. So that's really a fascinating topic. I also recommend one of our last shows. When you go to our website, look at some of the former shows that are there. We just did a cold calling show with Rod Santamassimo, and Rod got upset at me because he couldn't understand how I could mispronounce Rod. It's called A Cold Calling Day in Hell, and actually that is a fascinating show, not very legal, but some practical advice with that show. Also, a few weeks back, we had a fascinating show. One of our icons of real estate, Rand Sperry, one of the founders of Sperry Van Ess, and just really good lessons on how to be successful in commercial real estate and how he did it and some of his unique abilities. So with that, I'd like to thank Jeff. Jeff, thank you very much. You did a wonderful job on this show. And that is it. That's a close-up of the show. So thank you very much for listening. And, Jeff, I'll be in touch with you in the very near future.
Thank you, Howard.
I'll speak to you later.
This has been CRE Radio with Howard Klein. If you have a question or a topic you would like to discuss, Howard can be reached at 949-288-3707. That's area 949-288-3707. Or by email to howard@creradio.com. CRE Radio is a live and recorded radio show accessible from both the web and your smartphone. Visit creradio.com to download any broadcast anytime or to receive newsletters and updates from Howard. CRE Radio broadcasts are presented on an informational basis only, with the sole intent of educating our listeners. Howard and his guest conversations specifically do not intend to offer legal advice. If you need legal advice, we recommend you seek out your own counsel. Remember, laws and practices may vary from state to state. Please listen again next time to CRE Radio with Howard Klein. Unauthorized editing or copying of portions of this show without the express written consent of CRE Radio is strictly prohibited. All rights reserved.
And that's a wrap.